You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Up next, a look at the science behind the scenes of the new movie, Contagion.
The average person touches their face 3 to 5 times every waking minute. In between, we're touching doorknobs, water fountains, and each other.
And that's a scene from the movie Contagion, talking about how the virus in the movie is spread from person to person. And if you haven't seen it, we'll try not to give too much away here. We waited actually a few weeks until after the movie was out so that we could talk about it, and you will have seen it and you'll understand what we're talking about. So if you have seen the movie, you probably left the theater like I did, a little scared, wondering if what happened on screen could really happen in real life. And the movie follows the spread, as I say, of a virus which quickly turns into an epidemic. And part of the reason I think that the movie is so scary is because it sticks closely to reality. There are no zombies, no miracle cures, no Arnold Schwarzenegger type superheroes, just biologists with Eppendorf pipettes who try and save the day. And how did the film get the science right? With the help of a scientist, of course, and he's here to talk with us now. Ian Lipkin was the senior technical advisor for the movie Contagion. At his day job, he's a virologist. He's a professor of epidemiology and the director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Lipkin.
My pleasure. Love your show.
Thank you. How'd they get the word epidemiology wrong in the movie? You weren't on call that day.
No, you know, I had to go home periodically.
Now, this is interesting because you were not brought on at the end of the movie to fact check it, but right involved at the very beginning.
That's correct. And I've been asked to do movies like this in the past, but this was the first time I was convinced that they were really sincere in wanting to get things correct. That's not to say everything is correct in the movie, but, you know, it's a feature film. It's not a documentary. Mm-hmm. It's really very good.
So did you come up with the virus for this movie?
Yes. We threw out a number of candidates to Scott Z. Burns and to Steven Soderbergh, and this is the one they liked the best, which was fortunate because this is the one that we like the best as well. It makes sense. It's built on something that we've seen. It's probable. I shouldn't say it's probable. It's plausible. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting. I mean, there was a lot of opportunity to do interesting things with it cinematically.
And what was it based on?
It's based on a virus that was originally described in Malaysia that went from bats to pigs and was associated with encephalitis, primarily in pig farmers. And this was in the late 1990s. More recently, there have been some other reports in Bangladesh where it's transferred directly from bats to people through beverages. People tap trees for palm syrup and basically drink that as a beverage, and the bats can contaminate that. And it causes a respiratory illness and an encephalitis. It doesn't spread rapidly from person to person, but it could with mutation and evolution. Mm-hmm. So that was the modification that we suggested.
Mm-hmm. So you wanted the virus to look scary in people, too. So
exactly.
You added some foaming of the mouth and seizures and things like that.
Well, you know, your discussion just before the break was about epilepsy. So he neglected to mention the most common cause worldwide of epilepsy right now, which is MEV1. It's playing on every cinema theater.
Wow. Wow, that is scary.
Well, not for Warner Brothers.
You have actual personal experience with the outbreak of viruses. You were quarantined during the SARS outbreak, right?
Yeah, that's correct. In May of 2003, I went to China and actually used much of my experience there to help describe what scenes would look like, you know, deserted streets and airports and such. And when I came back, I became ill. And people thought that I had SARS. I felt that I didn't because my diagnostic test ruled it out, but I was indeed put in a quarantine. So I was able to talk to Matt Damon in the film about what that was like, to not be able to be in close contact with loved ones. Hmm. So a lot of this reflects experiences of people who've been involved with this film, personal experiences, which is one of the reasons it resonates with the audience.
There's a character scientist named Ian in the film. Is that there Ian is. Lipkin?
Yes, well, that's a character played by Elliot Gould. I'd been hoping for Matt Damon, but, you know, it's the way it goes. But, yes, that character is based on me.
And so you actually trained some of the stars like Elliot Gould and other people, to look like scientists and act like scientists?
Yeah, so Elliot, I only spent a few hours training, and essentially just to make sure that he was safe, because he was reaching into liquid nitrogen with bare hands, and that wouldn't have been a good thing.
Mm.
But Jennifer Ely, who plays the scientist at the CDC who identifies the virus and grows it and vaccinates herself, I'm spoiler alert there, I'm afraid, and Kate Winslet both spent a couple of days in the lab training and looking how to look, learning how to look through microscopes and work with pipettes and all these other sorts of things. And then I spent a fair amount of time with Gwyneth Paltrow working on her seizure, for example, to make that look realistic.
If anybody can look good having a seizure.
Absolutely.
It's Gwyneth Paltrow. But was Kate Winslet injecting herself, was that realistic?
Well, that was Jennifer, actually. So the initial injection, so as I say, I do have a day job, so periodically I would go offset. And during one of the times that I was offset, there was a decision that Jennifer would inject herself with this vaccine through her tights. And we were actually helping to record some of the soundtrack for laboratory sounds and cages rolling down halls. And as this film was rolling, I watched Jennifer inject herself through the tights, and I said, whoa, what's going on here? And we went back, and they said, well, she's really in a hurry. I said, no one is in that much of a hurry. She would take the time to roll down those tights and to wipe off her legs. So they actually brought her back, which was not an inexpensive thing to do, to reshoot that scene. And in so doing, not only did they shoot the scene properly, but we got a chance to see Jennifer Ely's thighs, which is also, helped, I think, with movie sales.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. But I'm impressed that they thought enough about the accuracy that they would spend money to do that. Is that right? Would that impress you too, I imagine?
It did. I mean, Scott Z. Burns and Steven Soderbergh, and as well as the people who put up the initial support for it, Participant Media, wanted to be involved with education. Both of the parents of Burns and Soderbergh are both academics, so they have a lot of respect for academia and for scientists in general. And so I was involved reading scripts right along for a very long time. They had other people as well. Larry Brilliant was reading. Laurie Garrett was reading, and so forth. So we spent a lot of time going over these, a number of times it would be something we'd put up which just wouldn't make any sense. And inevitably, they would revise it.
Yeah. In this movie, it's interesting is that the Centers for Disease Control seems to be the hero. The CDC is the hero in this movie, as where it might have been the demon if it had been someone, like FEMA or something like that in another scenario.
Absolutely. That's correct. And there are a number of heroes. Actually, each of these characters is modeled after somebody whom one of us has encountered in real life. So Jude Law, who plays this blogger who sells false hope, has been named after somebody who's been, casting doubt on the validity of vaccines. And we have people who die who are named after people like Carlo Urbani, who died during SARS. So I can see my friends in each one of these characters. Lawrence Fishburne, for example. Some of the characters are amalgams of people that we represent because, there wasn't any other good way to do it. But by and large, it's quite accurate, and it's rooted in reality.
So does that mean that you had a say in how the movie would end, how eventually the virus would play out?
Well, Steven Soderbergh is definitely the boss, and he has his vision. And Scott, of course, is the person who helps him develop that vision. My role was to say what's possible, what's plausible, what's feasible, what's not possible. And to some extent, that's incorporated, but it's definitely Scott and Steven's vision, certainly not mine.
Mm-hmm. The vaccine gets produced, I think, one of the most interesting, and I love the movie because it was interesting how it spread. It spread very quickly. But one of the things that didn't seem that believable to me was how quickly they could make a vaccine in that movie. I mean, today it takes months and whatever,
That's a criticism that I've heard from several people, but I don't agree. First of all, using molecular methods, we can make vaccines very quickly. Not for all viruses. Obviously, we've not succeeded yet with HIV, but for a virus like this, which causes very rapid disease, and for which we were able to grow the virus, and it's not really evolving that rapidly, we can make a vaccine very, very quickly. The problems really are logistical and regulatory. Mm-hmm. How do you make enough of it to distribute, and how do you get it through the FDA and the other bodies that need to approve it? But we do have, in government, ways in which we have, I don't want to call them loopholes, but basically that's what they are, where in the event of a national emergency, we can push things through quite quickly. It's a question of resources. So I don't think it's impossible, and I think it probably is a good idea to be able to do things on the time frame that we saw here.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your day job for a minute. You have discovered over 400 viruses.
Something like that.
Do you get viruses in the mail? Do they mail you candidates?
Well, they actually do arrive by mail, actually by courier service. And what typically happens is that somewhere in the world somebody will contact us about an outbreak or a single case of disease in a human or an animal, where there may be a collection of viruses that people simply want to know more about. And they will send those to us in dry ice, and we will use modern methods to sequence them and to characterize them. And we have 65 people, very talented people, who do this work. I don't. I just, I sort of pontificate in the background and write screenplays with Scott Z. Burns. But, you know, it's been an enormous amount of fun, particularly since I've been doing this kind of work since the early 1980s, when it was a much more tedious process. And the pace at which this information is accumulating is staggering. It's going up exponentially. So, you know, I can see that over the next few years, we're going to resolve not only all these sorts of, you know, outbreaks of acute disease, but also chronic diseases, the role of viruses and bacteria and things like diabetes and cancer and autism and what have you. So it's an enormous amount of fun and a great place to be. As I've told Stephen, I think he has the first, you know, I think I have a better job than he does. We disagree on that point.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR, talking with virologist Ian Lipkin. Have you seen any results from the publicity and people seeing the movie? Relating to viral research or the need for more money in research, anything like that?
Well, there are two things that we wanted to achieve, and I think I appreciate the question. One is that we do want to make sure that people realize that we need support in this area, and particularly in a time when funding is decreasing for science and it's in jeopardy. This, we hope, will lead people to realize that this is something we can need to support, because we're not like firemen and policemen that you see on the street rushing to an emergency of some sort. When public health people do their jobs well, you don't hear about us, right? We're successful. So we need to make people aware of what it is we do. The second thing, of course, is that we want to attract more people, some new blood into this field, because without that, we're not going to be able to progress. So increasingly, the work depends on mathematics and engineering, as well as traditional public health people and people who grow viruses and bacteria. So I think it has made a difference, but we're only just getting started. Remember, it's only just beginning to be released in Europe, and we have a global view. So we're trying to attract as many people into the theater as we can so that they better understand what we do.
One of the most telling scenes in speaking about the economics of this is, was it the governor who comes in? Was it Minnesota? And she says she's in this emergency healthcare facility they're trying to set up and say, who's going to pay for this?
That's exactly right. I mean, if we had an epidemic of this proportion, we would have a great deal of difficulty dealing with it. We don't have ways to isolate people. We don't have enough machines for artificial respiration. We don't have people who are sufficiently trained. So we're hoping to some extent that this is a wake-up call.
Mm-hmm. It's not like how are we going to get all these people in here and get them cured. It's how are we going to pay for this before anybody talks about it. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to a quick phone call before we have to go. Let's go to Chris in Minneapolis. Hi, Chris.
Hey, thanks. I was a little dismayed. I just saw the film last night, dismayed to see my city decimated in the film. But I know Scott Burns is from Minnesota, so it was fun to see us up on the screen. But I wanted to ask if there was is it as bad as it was depicted in the movie, or could it be potentially much worse than what was depicted?
Well, I think what we depicted was pretty bad. The likelihood that we're going to have something like this happen in the near term is small. On the other hand, we can prepare for this. One of the things that we try to convey to people is one of the most effective methods we have to prevent spread is with social distancing. And this is not something that's very popular in the Western world, but the scene where Lawrence Fishburne says, "Do you know where this bit about shaking hands comes from, right? Holding your hand out to show that you had no weapon, that you meant no harm." This was something that I encouraged Scott to put in there because I think that handshaking during months when we've got a lot of respiratory disease is probably not such a great idea. And coming to work when you're sick is probably not such a great idea. One of the misconceptions that you can draw from the trailer for the film where it says, don't talk to anybody, don't touch anybody, and so forth, many people present that as though we're saying, you should protect yourself by not touching anybody and so forth. But that particular scene is where Kate Winslet is telling someone who's on a bus, don't infect anybody else. So it really was a protect the herd, protect the community. And that's one of the messages that we're trying to get across in this film.
You think there's a sequel?
Not for me.
Too difficult? Too much time?
It was a lot of time. Yeah. It was an enormous amount of time. I spent 21 days on set, similar amount of time either training people or traveling on location or reading scripts. And, you know, my job is looking at real viruses. These guys can spread this gospel at this point better than I can.
And nothing spreads it like a film, does it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Good luck to you. Good job on the film.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Dr. W. Ian Lipkin was the senior technical advisor for the movie Contagion. He's also a professor of epidemiology and director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at the Mailman School of Public Health right here in New York at Columbia University. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help from NPR librarian Kim Oleski. And if you missed any part of the show, you want to hear it again, go over to iTunes and subscribe to our podcasts, our audio and video. Our video pick of the week is up there. So it's a dome home. I'm sure you're going to love to watch this dome home that Flora Lichtman has put together for you. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com. And you can take us along in your iPhone or Android app. And watch for a new version. A new upgrade is coming out very soon. And join a discussion on Twitter at SciFry, happening all week. And you could be part of our Science Friday community. Have a great weekend. If you're celebrating the new year, happy new year to you. And we'll be here next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.